Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment to discuss tomorrow's State of the Union address with a White House insider who has studied the Obama presidency and the president close up and personal. Jonathan Alter, the author of The Promise, joins us. Then we'll look into who the perpetrators of the airport bombing in Moscow might be, as well as examine the murky nexus between former KGB officers, politicians, oligarchs, and warlords in post-Soviet Russia, since many believe previous bombings attributed to terrorists have state fingerprints on them. Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College and a specialist on Russian internal security, joins us. And then we will talk with Jane Hampshire, the founder of FireDogLake.com, who was detained by MPs at the Quantico, Virginia base on her way to visit Bradley Manning, the Army private being held in solitary confinement in the brig, who is accused of supplying the trove of classified diplomatic and military cables to WikiLeaks. We have a lot to discuss, so stay tuned. Let us begin with a discussion of the state of the Obama presidency as the president prepares for his State of the Union address. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, who is a senior editor at Newsweek and an analyst for NBC News. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and most recently, The Promise, President Obama, Year One, now out in paperback with a new epilogue. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Jonathan Alter.
My pleasure.
And in your new epilogue, Jonathan Alter, you mentioned that back in early in 2007, the president, meeting with his inner circle, said, presidents only drive 20% of their agendas. The other 80% of the job is reactive. And that certainly has proven true in these past 2 years. Given the legacy of the Bush era with a near-death experience with the economy and the environmental disaster in the Gulf and this millstone of unemployment hanging around his neck, how do you think he's going to turn that around if indeed he hasn't begun to do that?
Well, I think he's begun to turn it around politically. He's risen a lot among independents, whom he had a huge problem with. Remember, he won independents handily in 2008, and Democrats lost them overwhelmingly in 2010. And in recent weeks, he's gained a lot of ground back with them. He's up around in the low to mid-50s in the approval rating. So that's the good news for him. The not-so-good news is that his fate over the next couple of years politically really depends on bringing that unemployment rate down at least some from 9.5%. And I don't think anybody knows whether he's going to be successful at that. We're going to hear tomorrow night some of what he plans to do about it. My own sense is I'm just a little more comfortable trying to look at events that have already happened that I tried to provide the backstory for in The Promise than in making speculating about things that may or may not happen. As you know as well as I do, the pundits are, myself included, are often wrong when we try to look into our crystal ball.
Well, one thing that history indicates is that presidents don't get reelected with anything over 7% unemployment. And he's got 9, close to 10, and it's, according to Bernanke, it's not going to go away for a couple of years.
I mean, these kinds of rules are made to be broken. I mean, Ronald Reagan was reelected overwhelmingly in 1984, despite unemployment that was, I think, a little bit over 7%, but he hadn't, really gotten it down lower than that. So a lot of it, I think, depends on whether the public feels that events are moving in the right direction or not. I think if he can get unemployment down to around 8%, and make people feel that things are, at least seeming to be headed in the right direction, and he's got a record to run on, he'll be okay. If it's up around 9.5 or 10%, he's in real political trouble.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One, now out in paperback. But I'm curious, Jonathan Alter, why from day one he didn't make himself the jobs president, the guy that's been handed this terrible plate of disasters. And there was some talk earlier, I recall, where he even himself said, maybe I'll be a one-term president. And in a sense, to share his dilemma with the American public, because they're not mutually exclusive. He wants to be a successful president, and the way to get successful is to have the economy revive. He seems to be doing that now by shaking down the CEOs and saying, come on, get to work, let's start exporting, let's get jobs going. In other words, share his journey. This is the great communicator.
Well, the big surprise to me when I was working on The Promise was that we expected him to be somebody who aced communications, you know, got an A+ because he'd been such a silver-tongued orator during the campaign, and that he would struggle in actually getting things done in executive management and leadership because he had no experience to speak of. And yet the reverse turned out to be the case. He struggled in communication. He had a lot of trouble framing a message, trouble selling what he was doing on healthcare, trouble pivoting to a jobs message. But if you look at the record, it's rather stunning. I mean, there was plenty of liberal criticism, you know, which I agreed with, that he didn't get a public option, and it would have been better to have a public option. But he was dealing in the real world where the votes weren't there for it, and he insured 30 million more Americans and ended discrimination against sick people, which, you know, we've had in this country for a long time. And this is the greatest piece of social legislation since the Great Society in the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson. And there was a lot of other legislation as well, but the consequence of that was that he wasn't able to develop the single-minded focus on jobs that the American people wanted, and he lost some of that connection, at least for a time, with the public. I think from their perspective, they felt like they had gotten through a $787 billion stimulus, which whatever Paul Krugman and, you know, some other critics might say, was as much as the political system would absorb, and more public investment than in his first month in office than Bill Clinton, for instance, had in 8 years in office, and that he came back at the end of the year of 2010 with what in effect was a second stimulus, a stealth stimulus that he got through using tax policy to stimulate the economy by cutting taxes on working families, although he had to swallow a continued tax cut for the wealthy as the price for that. But so he, you know, it's not like he hasn't been paying attention to trying to get the economy moving again, but he was first focused on preventing a depression, preventing things from getting a lot worse. If we'd stayed on the pace we were on in January of 2009 when he came into office, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month, and if we'd stayed on that pace, we would have been in another Great Depression, without exaggeration, by the end of the year. So the first thing he had to do was put a tourniquet on stop the bleeding. And so at least some of the promise is about how did they prevent a depression, and, you know, what kind of things did they do and not do. And so I think some people had expectations of him that were a little bit unrealistic, but you're quite right that he didn't tell a story and put it in the context of a narrative, and it's going to be interesting to see whether he does so tomorrow night.
And do you think in any way, Jonathan Alter, that it's fair for Rahm Emanuel to get some of the blame? I noticed today, of course, in your book, The Promise, in the epilogue of the new paperback edition, Jonathan Alter, you mentioned that Rahm Emanuel's ambition was always to be the first Jewish Speaker of the House, and his second choice was to be Mayor of Chicago, and the courts have apparently just taken that opportunity away, at least at this point. But you do mention that there was a dysfunction between Emanuel and Larry Summers and Axelrod that made the workings of the White House grind to a halt, if you will. I mean, everybody I talked to said that Summers wanted Geithner's job. He wanted Bernanke's job. He bullied everybody. He marginalized Volcker. I mean, the guy sounded like a one-man wrecking crew.
Well, Larry Summers is not thrilled by my book. I tell a lot of stories that confirm what you just said. Screaming match between him and Christina Romer, the chairwoman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and his sharp elbows and in keeping more liberal economists out of meetings, and this was, you know, part of the first year. But it's not a black and white story because, you know, some of what he suggested worked, and I think it's easy to just kind of dump it all on one person. But the story is a little more complicated. My overall critique of Summers' performance was that he kept the circle of advisors around the president too tight, and he did not push to use the leverage that Obama had when he had it. And they could have essentially dictated terms to the banks in 2009, and they didn't do so because Summers argued that they were too brittle and you know, not in a position to sustain that kind of pressure. I think he was wrong about that, but I think it's important to recognize that he was right in a lot of what he recommended that had the effect of preventing a depression. And if we hadn't made certain decisions, we would now be looking at 20% unemployment.
But so, Jonathan,
one of the things I try to do is paint a more complex picture, do less finger pointing and judging, and more telling people what actually happened, the backstory, what happened when that Oval Office door closed, because you don't hear about it on television and radio at the time. It's very, very hard to get. Mm-hmm. You have to go back later and do a lot of work with sources, as I did, to paint a true historic picture of what happened.
Well, part of the picture you've painted, Jonathan Alter, which I find fascinating, and I'm absolutely puzzled to why there's a consistency here. Al Gore effectively lost his presidency, even though arguably he won, and then conceded unnecessarily. He lost because he didn't go to the big dog, Clinton's help. He distanced himself and put Joe Lieberman on the ticket. And I read in your book, The Promise, that even the Obama's National Security Council and his staffers also tried to distance Obama from the big dog, who turned out to be very helpful. He made a deal with Putin when he happened to be with Putin when the spy thing happened, and he managed to make a deal that kept that thing from becoming a big deal. He also got the two women, actually Al Gore's women, out of North Korea. And they, you know, he seems like, and he also wrote up an enormous memo of how to deal with the economy that they weren't interested in passing on to the president. I'm just astounded by that.
Well, I was very surprised by it too, because the president managed to repair his relationship with Hillary Clinton, and yet with Bill Clinton there was a lot of tension, and I have a lot of stories in the book about that relationship. And I think you make a great point that he in some ways he sort of repeated Al Gore's mistake. Now, this is something that from a very early point, Rahm Emanuel, who was still close to Bill Clinton, still is, was just campaigning for him in Chicago a couple weeks ago. Rahm Emanuel was trying to make peace between the president and the former president. He considered it a priority, and it didn't really work. Now, at the end of last year, you remember that Bill Clinton, you know, stood there giving a press conference in the White House press room when President Obama, you know, left and let him do that, and they just had a long meeting. So I think their relationship is a little bit better. We don't know how much better because nobody else was in the room with them that day, but at least they're talking more often now. But the way the White House staff treated the former president, I found striking, and I charted that in the book. For the first 3 months of the Obama administration, he didn't exchange a single word with Bill Clinton, who was, the only ex-president who he really could learn much from. But there was just a lot of bad blood left over from 2008.
And Jonathan Alden, what is the explanation, though, for the big failure in the so-called shellacking that the president talked about in the 2010 midterms? I mean, one of the things you point out is that in 2008, 130 million people voted. In 2010, it was closer to 75 million. So it's almost half the people didn't vote. whose failure is that? Because, you know, it seems to me in this country you have these two parties. One of them doesn't have a natural majority, but they're very good at getting their people out to vote. And the other one that has a natural majority quite often doesn't inspire their people to vote.
Well, I'm really glad that you focused on that figure, because to me that's the most important statistic from the election, is that it's not really quite right to compare 2008 and 2010, because there were 55 million fewer voters in 2010. So when the Republicans talk about they have this mandate, you know, from 2010, I don't think they do. But there's always a drop-off in midterm elections, and it's not as steep as that all the time, but there's always some kind of a very, very significant drop-off, because a lot of what are called low-information voters, if the presidency is not on the line, they don't really care about their members of Congress and state legislators and that kind of thing, and they're busy with their lives and they don't vote. But it's true that there was an enthusiasm gap and that the conservatives had a lot of momentum and enthusiasm, and they ran a better campaign. The Democrats never really mobilized the 13 million Obama supporters who had been part of their network in 2008, what was called originally Obama for America and then Organizing for America, OFA, which is finally now getting into gear, but very late. And they just did not do a good enough job of getting their people out in most states. And they did not do a good job of crafting a message that people could really understand. And they offer a lot of excuses for that the BP oil spill prevented them from pivoting to the economy for the whole summer of 2010, and the economy didn't get didn't improve as much as they expected because of the Greek debt crisis, and then the crisis spread to the rest of Europe. But those are rationalizations, and they basically didn't get it done in 2010 until the end of the year, when the president, began focusing better on the political challenge in front of him. He got the message that he had to figure out how to get independence back and focus on the politics. I think for a long time he thought, I'll focus on the substance and let the politics take care of themselves, and he realized that that was a bit naive.
Heavens forbid that you should govern and not campaign, right?
Right, that's right.
So let me get just though in the last minute, because there's a lot of territory that we won't be able to cover, but just to deal with the State of the Union and the campaign, because in effect it seems like tomorrow night's speech may well be an opening shot in the campaign. And you say towards the end of the new epilogue in The Promise, Jonathan Alter, that the president has got to combat the Obama hate machine, the Fox News and the right wing, the Tea Party and all that stuff. And you don't know whether that 2010 is a prelude for a full conservative takeover of the United States or merely a mid-course correction. So just address that in the last minute, if you will.
Well, I think this is what's going to be so fascinating about the next couple of years, is that, this is a true battle over what our government is for. And the president's going to lay out a mission that is a couple hundred years old of what in the 19th century were called internal improvements, that we need to invest in our country to be great again. And the Republicans basically at this point only believe in two things, tax cuts and reducing the deficit. They don't have a vision of...
They're, of course, mutually exclusive, too.
and so that's right. They are mutually exclusive. This is both a substantive fight for what kind of country we live in, and also a knife fight. I know we're not supposed to use those violent metaphors anymore, but this is going to be a street fight, not at the presidential level, but on down the line, because there's an awful lot at stake in 2012. And what I try to do in The Promise is just give folks the background so that they can understand ongoing events with a little bit more historical perspective.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jonathan Alter.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's a senior editor at Newsweek and an analyst for NBC News. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and most recently, The Promise, President Obama Year One, just out in paperback with a new epilogue. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the bombing in Moscow. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's a political science professor at Barnard College, Columbia University. She's finishing a book on warlords and sovereignty, with one chapter focusing on Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya and his relationship with the Russian state. Her books include Enforcing the Peace, Learning from the Imperial Past, Weapons, Culture, and Self-Interest, Soviet Defense Managers in the New Russia, and Engaging the Enemy, Organization Theory and Soviet Military Innovations. Thank you for joining us here today, Kimberly Martin.
Thank you for inviting me.
And it's difficult to figure out who the perpetrators of this bombing at Moscow airport might be, although the security services in Russia say that they were tipped off a week ago that terrorist attacks were planned. Why they were unable to prevent it is another matter. But there have been in the past, there's kind of a murky nexus between former KGB officers, politicians, oligarchs, and warlords. And still many people believe that the previous bombings attributed to terrorists had state fingerprints on them, going back to the emergence of Putin and the beginning of the Second Chechen War. Has that led you to have any kind of suspicion in this regard? I mean, is that something we should have in the back of our mind?
No, I don't think so. I think they're two separate things that have to be kept separate. The bombings that originally happened in 1999, that were the apartment bombings that happened in Moscow and other Russian cities, those cases were ones where there was never a good investigation. They were blamed on separatists from the North Caucasus, but there are a lot of people, including a lot of very level-headed Western experts, who believe that the whole story has not been told there. And so in that case in 1999, we might have that suspicion. But since 2002, there have been a series of horrific attacks that have clearly been carried out by people who are from the North Caucasus. And so the latest attacks today actually fall into this pattern that has been happening for the last decade.
And, of course, there was the train, the St. Petersburg train in 2004. Two suicide bombers were able to board a plane at the very airport that was attacked yesterday and killing all 90 people on board. So we're certainly familiar with this. So what is the source of this? If, as you've profiled in your work, Kimberly Martin, the strongman down there in Chechnya is supposed to be keeping a lid on this, but clearly he's not.
Right. It has not been very effective at all. In the North Caucasus in 2010, the latest figures indicate that there were actually 1,700 deaths from political violence. And so a lot of that obviously doesn't get reported in the international media, but the problems in the North Caucasus are far from solved. And I think the truth is that experts don't really have a clear sense of why terrorist attacks happen. There is a lot of disagreement among people. A lot of different scholars have different perspectives on things. But I think what we need to pay attention to is the question of what motivates the leaders of the groups, what motivates the people who are actually willing to commit suicide in these attacks, and then the question also of what motivates the broader society in the North Caucasus to tolerate this, give shelter to people who commit these kinds of acts, rather than, for example, working with the police to make sure that they don't happen. And so I think there are three different things that we have to look at. In terms of what motivates the leaders, it's hard to know because there is a particular Islamist leader who takes credit, if you want to use that term, for all of these terrorist attacks, even when it does not appear that he is directly involved. And so just because even we know that someone from the North Caucasus has committed the attack, we don't necessarily know how tightly connected that is to a major group, how hierarchical the group is, or how much it is individual people who are motivated for various reasons going off on their own in the name of Islamism. It does appear that in this case, the attack was timed to try to embarrass President Medvedev as he was about to go to the major meeting of international business leaders in Davos, Switzerland. And certainly the fact that this attack happened at the international arrivals area for the major airport in Moscow that is the connector for European flights and flights coming in from London indicates that the effort in this case was designed to have an effect on Russia's international relations. That has not so much happened before. The attacks previously have been mostly oriented towards either ordinary people, for example, with the subway attacks, or towards the elite. The train that was hit going between Moscow and St. Petersburg was sort of equivalent to the Acela train that goes back and forth between Washington and New York that would be carrying people who are in the business world. So this is the first one that's really attacked an international audience, and it's probably not accidental in the timing as well, because Russia is preparing to hold the Olympics in 2014 in Sochi, which is a city located just outside of the North Caucasus area. And this was probably in part designed to try to make people feel as if they would be insecure if they attended the Olympics. So that's one set of issues. And the second set of issues that's very important is why people in the North Caucasus continue to tolerate this. And I think the answer behind that is that there is a complete lack of trust of the Russian authorities. The Russian police are known to be corrupt and to be very brutal. And there is also a sense, especially we saw with the ethnic rioting that happened in December in Moscow, of people from the North Caucasus not being able to make their way in society. They are considered second-class citizens by the ethnic Russian population.
Yeah, the term that's commonly used is chunya, right, which is the equivalent of our N-word.
Yes, exactly, exactly. What that means is sometimes you hear people say, oh, the terrorism is because of economic reasons, that it's the poverty. Well, I don't think there are any experts who believe that terrorism is caused by poverty because there's so many areas in the world that do have poverty that don't have terrorism. But instead, it's caused by hopelessness, by a desire for personal revenge, particularly for people who have had family members or close friends who have been treated badly by the Russian state or killed by the police. And it's also often done for reasons of humiliation, that if people feel that they have been degraded, that makes them want to get back at the state for degrading them. And so all of those things go into explaining what happened.
And that explains the participation of the widows in a lot of these. So you don't believe, for example, that the nationalist killings, the Spartak soccer game, you know, which were blamed on the Chechens. I mean, they are discriminated against. The country's been ravaged in successive wars. I still go back to that question of what are the Russians thinking by putting a thug down there just to beat people into submission? Is there a carrot and a stick? It sounds like from day one they've only had a stick.
Well, what's very clear in Chechnya is that they tried an experiment with Ramzan Kadyrov in the belief that maybe that would control the problem in the Caucasus. Ramzan Kadyrov was originally the son of the first leader of Chechnya after the Second Civil War there, who had also been put in place by Moscow. He was not an obvious person to take over the position from his father because he was very young when his father was assassinated. And what I trace out in the chapter in my book is exactly how, starting in about 2003-2004, Ramzan Kadyrov was able to get legal control over all of the security forces on Chechen territory. And it was because at each stage along the way, in that time, President Putin, now Prime Minister Putin, worked with Ramzan Kadyrov to push him forward and to give his militia more control over what was happening on Chechen territory. So there's no question that Ramzan Kadyrov was put in place by the central administration in Moscow as a sort of experiment to see if a strong man controlling the territory could work. What Ramzan was very good at, he's still very good at, is using his security forces to convince people to come over to his side. And he does that by engaging in extremely brutal activities. He tortures people. He kills people. He kills family members. He threatens to kill family members. He burns down houses in an effort to try to coerce people into coming over to his side. And at this point, approximately half of the Chechen security forces are actually these people that Ramzan Kadyrov has managed to turn to his side through these very brutal techniques. But if you think about that, it also means that people are not supporting Ramzan Kadyrov because they think he's a wonderful person. It means that half of his security forces probably are supporting him because they didn't feel that they had any other alternative except supporting him.
And well, it's sort of a version of the Stockholm syndrome, isn't it?
Well, in some ways, I think that it probably is. But what that also means is that the Russian state does not have very good control over what is happening in Chechnya. A lot of experts believe that rather than controlling terrorism and the terrorist threat, what Putin has succeeded in doing is controlling Chechen separatism. He has made sure that now Chechnya will say that it's a part of Russia, but he actually doesn't have much control over the security situation there. Because Ramzan Kadyrov has so much control, it means that he controls all of the information about what's happening on the ground. There are very few Russian personnel who are not from Chechnya that are left on the ground to do any monitoring of the situation for Moscow. So effectively what it means is that Putin, and now Medvedev following him, have essentially given sovereignty over to Chechnya after fighting two very bloody, very expensive wars to try to keep Chechnya on Russian territory. They have sort of sovereignty in name, but de facto it's Ramzan Kadyrov and his militia that control Chechnya, and they don't control it very effectively.
Well, I've always understood, though, again, I'm speaking with Kimberly Martin, who's currently finishing a book that in part examines the relationship between Chechen warlords and the Russian state. I was always understood, Kimberly, that there's a subtext in terms of oil pipelines, and that you could use the old adage from the Eisenhower days about what's good for GM is good for America, what's good for Gazprom is good for Russia. And they clearly want to be able to control the pipelines that extract energy out of Russia. And the only one that operates is through Georgia. And, you know, they've had a war with Georgia. Just in a broad kind of macro sense, do you think this is a big factor here?
No, it's not. In the mid-1990s, you're right. When the first Chechen civil war started, there was an oil issue that was associated with it because at that time there was a major pipeline that went through Chechen territory. After that first civil war, that pipeline was diverted. So there's no longer at this point a major pipeline that goes through Chechnya to the rest of Russia. There is some oil located on Chechen territory. It is a tiny fraction of the oil that's available on Russian territory as a whole. So it would be very surprising if that small amount of oil mattered all that much in Russian politics. And furthermore, there's no evidence that Ramzan Kadyrov would be somebody who did a better job of getting Putin's interest in the oil met in Chechnya than any other possible alternative would be. So there's no question Ramzan Kadyrov cooperates with Putin on oil issues in Chechnya. It's not really all that significant in terms of what's happening in Russia. And in fact, what has been happening recently, as Ramzan Kadyrov has been getting all of this power away from the central government in Moscow, is that he has pushed very hard to have Rosneft, a major state-owned oil company, which is often seen as a competitor to Gazprom, by the way, put a major oil refinery in Chechnya to replace one that shut down during the earlier civil wars. And after lobbying and lobbying and lobbying very publicly for this for a couple of years, finally this past fall, the announcement was made that, in fact, this refinery will be built. And it's sort of an odd place to build a refinery because Chechen oil is running out. It's a very small amount of oil. All the experts believe that within about 15 years, it'll basically have been run dry. It's an old set of oil fields. And so it's an odd place to put a refinery. And if anything, it indicates that Ramzan Kadyrov is using oil to his advantage rather than that Putin is interested in Chechnya because of the oil.
Pretty clear. And I mean, nothing is clear, obviously, in post-Soviet Russia, or not that it was clear during the Soviet Union. But there are lots of rumors that Kadyrov is behind the assassination of Anna Politkovskaya, and others with the Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent paper left in Russia. What would be the motives if this is true?
There is a very distressing tendency for any Russian citizen who delves too deeply into what Ramzan is doing to end up being assassinated. And so that includes people who are his political rivals within Chechnya, who might be a real challenge to his authority. And it also includes anybody who engages in muckraking, particularly on financial issues. So it's, you know, completely possible for somebody to criticize Ramzan and not to be in any danger. But people who go to Chechnya and try to do in-depth research and find out what's really going on and try to accuse him of corruption or financial wrongdoing do have a tendency to be murdered.
And an insider from the inner circle who ends up in Austria gets killed in the streets of Austria as well.
Right.
So just in closing then, I'm trying to understand here the broader future context of Russia's internal security problems and the notion of an Islamic threat within Russia, although the Islamic connection with Chechnya may be that murky because there's so much gangsterism and brutality. It's nevertheless a relatively small part of the Muslim parts of Russia. And Tatarstan, which is much closer to Moscow, I think it's about 15 million people there. So does Russia have, if it can't get a more subtle approach, shall we say, to dealing with these problems, does it have greater problems in the future?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind is that Islam in the Russian space has always been a very different form of Islam than the Wahhabist extremist Islam that's associated with terrorism. And so the terrorists that follow that particular form, that very minority form of Islam, really don't fit very well in the North Caucasus for the most part, especially in Chechnya. There's some other areas where there's been a longer history of them fitting well. So I think the issue is really not so much religion. It's not so much Islam. It's an ethnic population that feels that it cannot get ahead no matter what it does, that has a desire to take revenge because of what Russia has done beforehand, and that doesn't trust the authorities and doesn't trust the police.
So it sort of reminds me of the Tolstoy short story, The Cossacks. Is this a cultural history that the Russians have always beaten up on these people?
We have to be careful of historical determinism, because there are some people who look at Chechnya as being wild and ungovernable because of Tolstoy's history.
Mm-hmm.
And the history indicates that that's not actually true. And so we have to be careful of not engaging in ethnic stereotyping about who the Chechen population is. But Ramzan Kadyrov actually used money from his foundation to restore a home in Chechnya that had been used by Tolstoy during his visits.
Well, I'm fascinated by this conversation, Kimberly. We've run out of time, so hopefully we can revisit it, and not necessarily under these circumstances, but
yes.
Clearly this is something to explore further. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've been speaking with Kimberly Martin, who teaches political science at Barnard College at Columbia University. Her scholarship focuses on security issues in Russia and the former Soviet Union. She is finishing a book on warlords and sovereignty, with one chapter focusing on Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya and his relationship to the Russian state. We'll take a short break and return in a moment and talk with Jane Hampshire, who was just detained trying to visit Private Manning, who is accused of leaking the WikiLeaks. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Jane Hampshire, who's the founder of FireDogLate.com and one of America's most popular and influential political bloggers. She's also a motion picture producer who's made such films as Natural Born Killers, Apt Pupil, Permanent Midnight, and From Hell. Yesterday, she was detained at Quantico Marine Corps Base as she attempted to visit Bradley Manning, who is in solitary confinement there for allegedly handing over the trove of WikiLeaks diplomatic and military cables. Thank you for joining us here today, Jane Hampshire.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well,
something that just came in over the wire with your listeners, because literally it just came in front of me.
Go ahead.
Military officials have confirmed to MSNBC that Brig Commander James Averhart did not have the authority to place Manning on suicide watch for 2 days last week. They are admitting that they did the wrong thing. I am really, really happy.
So what did they do to you, though? I mean, you've been visiting there with David House, who is the second on the list of visitors after Private Manning's lawyer. So why this time were you detained?
Well, that's a good question, and only the people who did the detaining know that for sure, but I can tell you why I think they did it. I am just the driver. David has been staying with me when he comes down. He's 23 years old. He's a student. And he has been, you know, putting together the defense fund for Bradley Manning and really standing up in his defense. And he's been harassed, as have all the students that have come to Manning's defense. They've been investigated by the Army Counterintelligence, the FBI, Homeland Security. They've been stopped and searched when they try and leave the country. David had his computer seized by the military, by the FBI. And they've really managed to scare off everybody but David from coming to see Bradley Manning. So I was just someone who allowed him to stay at my house and drove him down to Quantico. But every time we've been before, things have been fine. They let me on the base to drive David to the brig and then told me to go sit at McDonald's until visiting hours were over, then pick him up. So I did. This time, they were very upset. And the minute we drove up, it was clear that they were going to harass us and detain us. And we asked why, and they said that they had orders to do that. And
they said the orders came from the top, right?
Yes, and by the end of the ordeal, there were, you know, high-ranking military people in the guardhouse with the military police who were detaining us. And it was clear that they did not want David to go see Bradley that day. David, as you mentioned, is really his only visitor other than his attorney anymore. And David had been out of the country raising money for Bradley's defense in Europe for a month, so Bradley hasn't had a personal visitor for over a month. And they kept us until 2:50 and then finally released us. And that meant that visiting hours were over at 3 o'clock and David couldn't visit him. So.
And David had previously said that he was concerned about Bradley Manning's physical and psychological condition.
That's why I think that they did it. I think that they were punishing David for speaking out. He was one of the sources, but the primary source, I would say, for the stories that came out last month.
So just give us a sense of what's going on here with this suicide watch.
Let me explain a little bit. So they are holding him in the brig at Quantico, and he's in the Army, but the Quantico brig is a Marine facility. And they claim that they are not holding him in solitary confinement because there's no reason to hold him in solitary confinement. He hasn't been convicted of anything. They haven't tried him. But they couldn't do that, so they say, no, they are not holding him in solitary, they're holding him on suicide watch. Well, basically, suicide watch allows you to do the same thing that they do, and he'll do in solitary confinement, but it's just for the person's own good. The problem is that three psychiatrists have said that Bradley Manning is now at risk of suicide, three base psychiatrists. And so so when last week they had put Bradley under suicide risk, which meant that he, instead of being in his cell 23 hours a day, he's now in 24. They took his glasses away, except for small periods of time, so he couldn't read. He was left in his underwear. They sort of awakened him, not awakened him. I want to be very specific about this. They asked him questions every 5 minutes to make sure he was okay. When he was asleep, if they couldn't see him and he was curled up next to the wall, they woke him up to ask him, if he was, okay. And basically it's the conditions of solitary confinement under another name. And so the lawyer for Bradley Manning had written a protest last week, filed an Article 138 complaint, saying that the brig commander had exceeded his authority in doing this against the recommendations of three psychiatrists.
He's not the only person. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, has submitted a formal inquiry to the State Department about Manning's treatment. And so has Amnesty International has written to Defense Secretary Robert Gates. So about Manning's inhumane and unnecessarily severe treatment. What do you make of this, Jane Hampshire? I mean, it's so extraordinary that if it's true that they're treating this guy inhumanely, and it's the military itself who's at fault for the leaks. I mean, if they're the custodians of the secrets, it's their mistake, isn't it? I mean,
I want to emphasize one thing, and I think because there's been so much propaganda released, nobody knows what Bradley Manning did. He hasn't confessed to anything or made any public statements. Everything we know about what he may or may not have done has come from a guy named Adrian Lemieux, a hacker who is an extremely unreliable source and has made up, a convicted hacker who has made up, who has said many conflicting things.
Right, and he I think you could describe him as an FBI snitch, couldn't you?
That is exactly what he is. So I don't know what Manning did, quite honestly. I couldn't say, oh, he didn't do what they claimed he did, or that he did the things that... I can't say one way or another what he did. If it doesn't matter what he did, he hasn't been tried and convicted.
Right. I'm just wondering, though, whether this is a kind of... It seems such a misdirection that all of this anger is directed at this guy, and if it's true that these secrets were left the military, it's the nobody in the entire U.S. security world seems to be looking at themselves. They seem to be looking at this poor guy as a scapegoat. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Oh no, and I think that that's a valid point. My sort of position with regard to, you know, what doesn't matter what your position about what he's alleged to have done is, if you should not be able to be labeled an enemy of the state like this and essentially tortured like this. And the New York Times has reported, Charlie Savage has reported, that the Justice Department's plan on WikiLeaks now is to try and get Manning to roll over on Julian Assange in exchange for a deal. And so coming at a time when he's being, you know, held on suicide watch / tortured for his own good, and he can't have visitors. They're detaining his only visitor and keeping them, clearly for the purpose of making sure that he can't get in to see him in the brig after he hasn't been there for a month. That was the most frustrating thing yesterday. It wasn't anything else that was happening, that we were being harassed. And, you know, you sign up for that when you enter the WikiLeaks world, right? You know that's what you're going to get. It's that we were what they were doing to us was a way of making the conditions worse for Bradley Manning. So I started tweeting. When the good Lord gives you 8,000 Twitter followers, you use them. And I was just tweeting to let people know what was happening because I didn't know what was going to happen. They were threatening to arrest us. And so I called my lawyer and started tweeting away about everything they said, in a sort of moment-by-moment basis. And the next thing I knew, like, you know, I wasn't even looking at whether anybody was responding or not. I was just putting it out there. And there were tons of people following, and everybody was talking about it. And then today, Jake Tapper of ABC News asked Robert Gibbs about Bradley Manning's condition. That's never happened before. So, and the military looks like they may be really releasing the POI, the suicide watch that they've kept Manning under. I mean, that's amazing. If that happens, that will be a remarkable day.
Well, it seems that this is that we know that there's a secret grand jury impaneled in Northern Virginia, and that there are these rumors out of the Justice Department that they're trying to use Bradley Manning to, in effect, charge Julian Assange with receipt of stolen property, if you will. I don't know obviously it won't be exactly that, but that's the idea, I think. Otherwise, they don't have a case because the First Amendment gets in the way. So is that your understanding, that what's going on here?
That they are trying to make a connection between an actual connection.
Yeah,
between
that somehow Assange helped in the removal of it. The stuff wasn't dropped off.
Absolutely, they've been trying to make that, and they've been trying to get Julian Assange to confess to that. But in this MSNBC story today, U.S. military officials tell NBC News that investigators have been unable to make any direct connection between a jailed Army private suspected with leaking secret documents and Julian Assange.
Right.
This is remarkable. They've been trying to make that case forever, and they haven't been able to do it. And they weren't able to get Bradley to make a false confession, which is usually what one is trying to do when you're torturing somebody and refusing to give them due process.
And when you use the word torturing, explain that.
Well, I think that the deleterious effects of this quote-unquote suicide watch on Bradley, keeping him in his cell 23 hours a day. He's unable to exercise. At the time David made his revelation about Bradley's physical condition having deteriorated and his mental condition, he had not been allowed to read any books for months, any reading material whatsoever. It was sensory deprivation. And if anybody, looks at what the effects of solitary confinement are on people, it is in fact torture.
So, I hate to segue away from this extraordinary story that you're telling us and that you participated in live yesterday, and it is an extraordinary thing that these tools like Twitter exist. I must say that your use of them has been quite revealing. Just in closing, though, do you want to comment in any way on what happened with Rahm Emanuel being the other headline today that the courts have – because apparently I was just talking earlier on the program with Jonathan Alter, who said that Emanuel's two ambitions in life were to become the first Jewish speaker of the House and, if that didn't work out, the mayor of Chicago. And it looks like the courts are throwing a monkey wrench into that one.
What can I say? God likes me today.
So, all right. Then another question, if you don't mind. What do you think is going to happen tomorrow with the State of the Union? Do you think that it will be a celebration of centrism, or is there a way? Will it be an opening shot in campaign 2012? What do you expect?
Well, I think everybody was hearing that the president was going to come out in favor of cutting Social Security benefits in order to cut the deficit, and now reports are coming out today that he won't. So, that was a victory too. But I think that he will, quite predictably, come out for closing the deficit, which is, really what he wants to run on in 2012, and talk about jobs. So I don't think there's going to be, a whole lot of surprises. If I knew what they were right now, they wouldn't be surprises, would they?
Well, it's true, but I mean, I can't believe that anybody can't explode the Republican mantra, which is inherently contradictory, that they want tax cuts and to deal with the deficit. Why would he drink the deficit Kool-Aid without at least refuting the absurdity of the Republican position?
Well, he seems to have pretty much bought into it. I mean, at least that's my observation, but I welcome what anybody else's opinion of that is. I think that he really does believe that he needs to cut the deficit. He has said so repeatedly. So,
but Social Security is one of the few things in the government that actually pays its way.
It absolutely does.
And, in fact, it has a massive surplus.
Yes, but for whatever reason, that was the recommendation that the Deficit Commission came up with, and that was what people were hearing, the president moving forward. So now it seems like he won't, so I think that that's going to be a good thing. I think a lot of people are more interested in finding out, there's more betting going on tonight about what Supreme Court justices will show up tomorrow than the content of Obama's speech.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jane, and for sharing your extraordinary experiences yesterday, and we're very
so
appreciative.
Much. All right.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just picking them with Jane Hampshire, founder of Fire Dog Late, who was detained yesterday as she attempted to visit Bradley Manning, who's in solitary confinement at the Quantico Marine Base in Virginia. I'd also like to thank producer Spencer Downing and assistant producer Sammy Su Mong Hong and engineer Devin Jordan. I'll be back tomorrow with another background briefing. Until then, bye for now.